Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We keep hearing that the past year has been stressful for any number of reasons, and that isn't just talk. It has been stressful, even for those who kept their jobs. The pandemic upended our lives and disrupted routines. It also led to some people adopting habits that they'd rather not have adopted, like procrastination, stress eating, drinking more than normal, and increasing a habit that many of us had before the pandemic, endlessly turning to our phones for distraction, even endless doom scrolling on social media. These habits didn't just magically present themselves out of boredom. There are underlying causes, including increased levels of anxiety. And it isn't just you. Experts have noticed those levels rising, along with other mental health issues, during this pandemic year. Anxiety is never good, and those habits aren't either. To get a handle on the latter, you have to address the former. And our guest today says that breaking these habits begins with breaking the cycle of anxiety. Willpower and simply trying to change your mindset does not work. And he should know. Dr. Judson Brewer is an internationally renowned addiction psychiatrist and neuroscientist and author of Unwinding Anxiety. New science shows how to break the cycles of worry and fear to heal your mind. He is also executive medical director of behavioral health at ShareCare. That's a digital health company. He joins us for the hour. Thanks for being here. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You say that anxiety drives anxiety. Are you saying that it builds on itself? It's a multiplier?
It absolutely. So if you think of the definition of anxiety, which is this feeling of worry or nervousness about an imminent event or something with an uncertain outcome, if we zoom in on that piece of worry, worry can be a feeling, but it can also be a mental behavior. And if we start to feel anxiety, that can actually lead to worry as a behavior, which can then feed back and make us more anxious.
Now, we all have moments of anxiety. So the anxiety that we're going to spend the hour talking about here, is this something more than, is this chronic anxiety, or this is not the momentary thing if we have to speak in front of the JCs or something and we have anxiety about that? That's not what we're talking about, right?
Well, the feeling of anxiety is something I think we all know. And the piece that we can really dive into is, when is it just temporary? When does it just show up? Why does it show up? And when do we actually feed it so it sticks around longer than we'd like it to?
Okay. You begin your first chapter with this sentence. Anxiety is like pornography. It's hard to define, but you sure know it when you see it. Unless, of course, you can't see it. We don't notice these unsettled feelings?
Well, I wrote a little personally there because I didn't know that I had anxiety back when I was in college. You know, I was thinking, well, I run every day, I play the violin, I'm a vegetarian. How could I possibly be anxious? And in fact, it was showing up in my GI system. I won't go into the details, but let's just say that my GI tract wasn't the happiest. Uh-huh. And it was letting me know that that was actually anxiety. I didn't think it was anxiety. I thought it was a bacterial infection.
And in fact, I read that the doctor that you went to see, he was a doctor and you were not, but as we all do now, we self-diagnose. He gave you an antibiotic knowing full well it wasn't going to do anything, but you wanted it, so he gave it to you, which is part of the problem with antibiotics, but that's another show entirely. Yes. So anxiety may be hard to define, but I'm going to ask you to define it and to give us some signs that we can spot in ourselves, perhaps, mm-hmm. if we can't recognize it without prompting. Maybe you could help us recognize it.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the key features is worry. So this feeling, and it tends to feel restless, it tends to feel a little contracted, like a little tightening down. It can show up as tightness in our bodies, whether it's our shoulders or our jaw or even our eyes. And then accompanying that is this mental thing that's constantly happening where we're worrying, where we're thinking, you know, what could happen here? What could happen here? What could happen here? As we're kind of thinking through all these worst case scenarios. So you can think of it as kind of this fear of the unknown, where our brains are just really, they're spinning out of control worrying about things.
So anxiety was around long before this pandemic. But as I mentioned in the opening, there are a lot of people who have developed these habits that are, as we're going to find out, connected to anxiety, even though they don't know that they are. And I'm just curious as to whether from your clinical practice that you have noticed that this pandemic is in fact driving a lot of this, has and has the nature of the anxiety that people suffer changed in any way because of the pandemic?
Yeah, it's a great question. I haven't seen that the nature has changed. So really, you know, our brains don't like uncertainty. And when, you know, it's kind of like our stomach rumbles when we're hungry and it says, go get some food. Mm-hmm. When there's something that's uncertain or our brain doesn't have information, our brain kind of rumbles and says, go get that information. Yet when we don't have, you know, when there is uncertainty, then that starts to spin out into anxiety. So this was there way long, you know, BC, you know, before COVID-19, even though that seems like it's ancient history. We'd, you know, with uncertainty, you know, we've been seeing this politically with, you know, uncertainty in terms of how political actors were acting, uncertainty around jobs, around the environment. So certainly we'd seen this previous to 2020 in last year when the pandemic really exploded. So did anxiety, because there was even more uncertainty, whether it was health related, job related, economy related, schools related, you know, are kids going to be in school? Are they not going to be in school? All of these things just really made it explode.
Hey, you also wrote, I'm going to come back to this political aspect of this in a second, but you also wrote in the New York Times that uncertainty connected with life in the era of COVID can lead to contagious anxiety. What did you mean by that?
Well, there's a, I think there's a really important piece here, which is you can think of, we can prevent the spread of a physical virus through social distancing, wearing face masks and things like that. But somebody can sneeze on your brain from anywhere in the world on social media, meaning that we can spread emotion from one person to another and you don't have to be in the same room. You don't even have to be near somebody. If somebody's excited about something, we can get excited just by listening to a podcast, for example. If somebody is freaking out about something on social media, if we go on social media and we start doom scrolling, we can catch that contagion.
Is anxiety necessarily a bad thing? I mean, it seems to me that there are moments when we experience anxiety where those feelings are logical. We should feel anxiety about what's about to happen to us in certain situations. It seems to me to be part of our fight or flight protection syndrome that every human being has, otherwise we wouldn't be on the planet anymore. So how do we recognize the difference between anxiety that has a logical connection and we should be afraid or concerned, and anxiety that is illogical and that we're overblowing things and we could actually control this if we knew that?
I think you're highlighting a key distinction here, which is, you know, our survival mechanisms, like you said, help us survive. Fear is a big survival mechanism for us. So for example, you know, if we walk out into the streets and we don't see a car coming, we see it, we jump back onto the sidewalk, we have that fear response that says, hey, you know, put your phone away or whatever it was that caused us not to look both ways. And then remember to look both ways before crossing the street. So that fear is a learning mechanism. In fact, it only takes three things to learn something. And any habit is formed this way, a trigger, a behavior, and a result. So if the fear response is learned through, you know, we look at the street and we remember, oh, last time I almost got hit by a car, then that prompts us to look both ways. And then we learn that. So fear is helpful. But if you think of fear adding, you know, kind of building on or even adding with uncertainty, we get anxiety. So there hasn't been anything that's been shown that anxiety has actually improves performance. Or in fact, it makes our working, you know, memory, it makes our thinking brain go offline. So there's this myth around performance anxiety, for example, where people think, oh, I have to be anxious to perform. And I write about this in the book, where my old PhD mentor used to call this true, true, and unrelated. He said, is something true and is something else true, but are they actually related? So A, I could be anxious, that could be true. B, I could perform well, that could be true, but is A, anxiety causing me to perform well? In fact, when people look at the research, the majority, if not all the studies show that any increase in anxiety actually decreases performance. And if you look at the opposite of that, where somebody is just truly in the moment, they're truly just engaged with what they're doing. You know, the psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi described this as flow. That's anti-anxiety. That's the opposite of anxiety. And that's where people are performing at their best.
And we're going to talk as we go through the hour about how to get control of this, things that you can do, techniques that you can use to, once you recognize that you're going through these things, to put them in abeyance, to tamp them down. You mentioned politics a second ago, and we've been through a year unlike any I can remember, and probably a very rare year in the history of mankind, with this pandemic that upended all of our lives, changed everything about how we work. I mean, I'm doing the show from home. You're doing the show, from your office or from your home as well, as opposed to going to a studio and sitting in a soundproof booth and doing things logically like broadcasting is supposed to be. And that has caused some anxiety for a lot of people who had to change their work habits, their learning habits, etc. And all of this came along at a time when political anxiety within this country was rising to its heights toward the end of the Trump administration and the presidential campaign. And I don't care whether you're a Republican and a Trump fan or a Democrat and not, there was anxiety that you could not deny among all of that. And that presidency, where we have political rhetoric, a chaotic approach to the job, our social mores being upended, a whole new view of what truth is, had to be anxiety-causing for a lot of people. Was this a double whammy? Are we suffering from that as well as the COVID upending?
I think so. And it's not, you know, it's not that Trump is special in any particular way around, you know, this, but I think the chaos that you're describing is really the things that our brains don't like. So, you know, if you look historically at political figures, and I'm not a historian, so I don't want to step outside of my lane here too much.
Right.
But from a basic psychological standpoint, you know, politicians are supposed to be measured. They tend to give a political answer to anybody's question, which can drive people crazy because they feel like they haven't actually answered the question. But the idea is for them not to freak out their constituency, to say something and for their constituents to basically know what they're going to be saying. With, when somebody says things, when somebody's very unpredictable, it really drives our brains crazy because we don't know what they're going to say next. It's very much like the formula that casinos use with slot machines. It's called intermittent reinforcement, where, you know, if you go and play the slots, you know exactly when you're going to win, then you just go and play until you win and you leave, right? But the idea is that the house always wins. And the way for the house to win is to keep you winning just enough so you keep playing, so that you spend more than you actually make. And the way they do that is they give you basically random rewards. You don't know when you're going to win. That's what's called intermittent reinforcement. And we've seen, you know, in the last couple of years, more uncertainty in terms of you don't know what a certain politician is going to say when, you know, and I'll just be explicit. You know, Trump, he revved up his base and he also drove people crazy through people not knowing what he was going to say next. And some people loved it and some people hated it.
We're talking to Dr. Judd Brewer, a medical doctor and a PhD psychiatrist and neuroscientist, about anxiety and unwinding it. And we'll get into that when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Judd Brewer is our guest. He has his own website, drjudd.com. He's also the Director of Research and Innovation at the Mindfulness Center and an Associate Professor of Psychiatry in the School of Public Health at Brown University. and the author of Unwinding Anxiety, New Science Shows How to Break the Cycles of Worry and Fear to Heal Your Mind, which is what we'll be getting into in the next few minutes. Anxiety can come from many different sources, for many different reasons. Sometimes it's a logical fear that raises our anxiety hackles. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's all imagined, and we just become paralyzed by that. And you can tackle both, according to you, through mindfulness, which is something we will be talking about. But for now, you say that the approach to getting both real and imagined, would you say that both the getting both under control, real and imagined anxiety, is the same? Is the approach the same?
Yes, I would think, you know, anxiety typically comes from this. We imagine things, you know, we worry about things that we don't know. It's basically this fear of the future. Mm-hmm. And that imagining actually leads to this real feeling of anxiety, but that both are very much intermixed.
So you say that anxiety is often masked by addictions and bad habits that we cannot break. And I mentioned a few, like constantly looking at our phones or drinking more than we'd like to, or stress eating, which has a lot of people have been doing during this pandemic. Are they the only ones, or are there a plethora of things that manifest, behaviors that manifest themselves when we're stressed out or anxiety prone?
Yeah, I think this could happen. It's very individual. So you name some of the big ones, especially we've seen these rise a lot over the last year, you know, stress eating, where people have ready access to their refrigerators, or doom scrolling, where, you know, we've got our phones in our pockets, or increases in drinking, where folks are near their liquor cabinets, where they might not be in the workplace. But this really can manifest with any behavior that helps us temporarily alleviate the anxiety. So you could think of that anxiety and our brain saying, ooh, this is uncomfortable, make it go away. And so we do something, we eat some food, we drink some alcohol, we go on social media, and we temporarily feel better. And then our brain learns, hey, do that again next time. So it could be anything from biting our fingernails to, you know, to picking our hair, you know, hair pulling, many things that can happen from this.
You are a neuroscientist and a psychiatrist, and you say that you didn't recognize the connection between these habits that we developed in response to anxiety and the underlying anxiety that many people suffer. It came kind of as a gestalten awareness to you. Why, after all that training and all that education, did this suddenly occur to you and you began to explore it as a research project?
Yeah, it was really serendipitous, because I had trained in medical school in residency to prescribe medications for anxiety. And, you know, in fact, I was getting a little anxious about how to treat my patients with anxiety, because the gold standard class of medications, there's this term in medicine called number needed to treat, meaning how many people you need to give a treatment to before one person serves a significant benefit. That number with medications is 5.15, meaning that I would have to treat 5 patients before one person showed a significant benefit. So I was basically playing the medication lottery and not knowing which of my patients were going to benefit and what I was going to do to help the other 80%, you know, the other 4 out of 5 that weren't being helped. So at the time, I was studying an app called Eat Right Now that we had developed to help people work with stress eating and emotional eating. And one person said to me, who was a pilot tester, I think, she said, you know, I'm realizing that anxiety drives me to stress eat. You know, you and I just talked about that. She said, can you develop a program for anxiety? And I was thinking, well, I prescribe medication, so I'm not sure how I can be helpful. Yet that put a bug in my ear to go back and look at the literature. And it turns out back in the 1980s, so this was back when the Stones were singing about Mother's Little Helper, which is, you know, benzodiazepines. That's how they were being prescribed, like candy, you know. So back then there was all this focus on medications, Prozac, for example, the first SSRI was developed in the 80s. But people were ignoring this research that was suggesting that anxiety can actually be driven habitually. And so when I went back and read this literature, I thought, oh, wow, I'd never thought about this. And I know how to work with habits, you know? So that's when we started developed this Unwinding Anxiety app and started testing it to see if it could help people by helping them work with anxiety as a habit. And that's what actually led to me writing this whole book. It was so so interesting, so illuminating, and our research was so revealing there.
So which comes first in your mind, recognition of the bad habits that we have developed because of anxiety, or the fact that we have anxiety and that has led to the development of these habits? Which comes first? Which do you tackle first?
Well, I tackle whichever is most right in front of somebody. So somebody might have the habit of stress eating. It's kind of like me in college where, you know, the physician said, oh, are you anxious? I'm like, no, I'm not anxious. So if my patient comes in and, you know, they're stress eating and they say, doc, I want help with my stress eating, you know, I might trace it out with them, but I might not start with the anxiety piece first. I might say, well, you know, let's see what's causing, you know, like as you start to identify these habit loops around stress eating, what's leading to that so that we can back into it. For other folks, just by taking their history, you know, I'm thinking of a patient, I think I wrote about him in the book, where he was referred to me for alcohol use disorder because he was drinking so much. But as we mapped it out, I said, you know, go home and start figuring out what is leading to the drinking. And he came back a couple of weeks later and realized, oh, this was actually anxiety that was driving it. So at that point, he was ready to tackle his anxiety.
You say that if we notice these habits, if we've noticed that we're drinking more than normal, if we've gained a few pounds, if we recognize that we're eating when we're not really hungry, we're just eating because it makes us feel better momentarily. If they're the result of anxiety, simple willpower will not allow you to conquer them. Why not? I recognize I'm overeating. I'm going to stop. Why? Yeah.
There was a great skit from Bob Newhart from the 1970s. Do you know Bob Newhart? Sure. So there was this woman comes into this therapist's office, right? That's Bob Newhart. And she says, you know, I have this problem. And he says, I mean, I'm going to charge you for 5 minutes, but that's all you'll need. And she's incredulous. And then she tells him what the problem is. And then he just leans over his desk and he says, just stop it. So what you're talking about has been around forever, right? Wouldn't it be great if my patients came into my office and they said, you know, I said, just stop smoking, just stop overeating, just stop worrying. So there's this idea, this heuristic, that it'd be a great idea if we could just tell ourselves to stop doing these things, if we could use our willpower to overcome them. The problem is, that's not how our brains work. You know, the willpower part of the brain is the youngest and the weakest part of our brain when it comes to anything. So it's the first that goes offline when we get stressed. And ironically, it goes offline when we get anxious. So we can't rely on it.
Let's bring into this trigger behavior result concept that I've actually heard before. But if anxiety leads to bad habits, and it's clear that it does, and since many of us have developed those habits during this pandemic, let's talk about how those habits form and how they are connected to anxiety. Sometimes habits are driven by, you say, one of the most evolutionarily conserved learning processes currently known in science, positive and negative reinforcement. And that gets back to this trigger behavior result. Explain that.
Yes. So any habits form this way. It goes back to our ancient ancestors who didn't have refrigerators. So they had to go find food every day. And they also had to, when they were out foraging for food, they had to make sure they didn't get eaten, right? So find food, eat, and not be eaten, survive. And the way they learned and the way we still learn is through positive and negative reinforcement. So positive reinforcement is, you can think of the food thing. You know, you see some food, there's the trigger, you eat the food, there's the behavior, and then your stomach sends this dopamine signal to your brain that says, remember what you ate and where you found it. Mm-hmm. So it really helps us lay down context-dependent memory so we can remember where food is. Same for danger. We see the saber-toothed tiger, you know, in some part of the savannah or the woods or whatever, and then we learn, oh, that's a dangerous part of the, you know, of the savannah, don't go there again. So that's negative reinforcement, which basically says avoid bad things. And the way that these habits form around anxiety is anxiety feels unpleasant. And so we stress eat or we drink or we scroll on social media. That's the behavior and we feel a little bit better or we distract ourselves. And that feeds back and says, oh, next time you're anxious, you should do that again. And it's funny that we can actually develop the mental behavior of worrying as a way to feel in control or at least feel like we're doing something when we're anxious, even if it's not actually solving a problem or keeping our family safe or whatever our brain thinks it's helping with.
Right. So what you're saying is that going back to this very simple example of cavemen trying to find food and not be eaten in the process, that when they find food, they go, oh, good, calories. I'm going to eat that. And then they remember that this is where I found the food. It made me feel better. So I'm going to go back to that place again and do this again. I'm going to repeat that behavior because it makes me feel good. How then do we misassociate those feelings? In other words, if we're eating just because we're stressed, because it makes us feel good when we eat, but it doesn't make us feel good necessarily or feel better because we have underlying anxiety, why would we just not try that once and realize, well, that doesn't work. I'll try something else. But we stick to it. Why?
We do because there's this temporary, whether it's a dopamine hit or a distraction from the underlying anxiety. And so our brain associates, if I distract myself from the feeling of anxiety, I actually feel better. So it might feel a little bit better for the moment, but it doesn't, I think, as you're pointing out, it doesn't fix the root cause of the anxiety. Yet we're distracted and our brain thinks, distraction must mean it fixes it because our brain is just saying, oh, this feels better, as compared to our thinking, that's our survival brain. Our thinking brain, when it looks back on the situation, it says, well, that didn't actually fix anything. And now I'm gaining weight or whatever the secondary issue is that comes from that.
So the same thing would apply to checking your cell phone constantly to know it occupies your time. It maybe takes your mind off the anxiety momentarily, but it doesn't really solve the problem. The same is true with smoking. The same is true with drinking. The same is true with any of these habits that we develop in response. You say that willpower, as we've said, to break these habits does not work, but curiosity can help you. I always thought that curiosity killed the cat, but evidently not in this case. What does that mean? Curiosity will help you.
Yes. So the ways that our brains work is actually through what's called reward-based learning. When we've been talking about this, positive and negative reinforcement are basically reward-based learning processes, which is just a fancy term for saying, if something's rewarding, we're going to do it again, whether it's pleasant and we continue the pleasant things, or whether it's unpleasant and we make the unpleasant things go away. So that we can actually start to do two things with that. One is start to see how unrewarding our old habits are. So for example, if I stress eat because I'm stressed or I'm anxious, and I start to ask myself, is this actually fixing the root cause of my anxiety? And I see that it's not, then it starts to become less exciting. My brain is less excited to do that in the future. So that's one thing that curiosity can help us with, is to ask ourselves, is this really helping me? Same for worry. If I worry about this, is it actually going to solve the problem? Is it going to keep my family safe? Is it going to do what it's intended? No, in fact, worry doesn't solve the problem and it just makes me more anxious. So that helps decrease that reward value in our brain for whatever the behavior is that's not helping, whether it's stress eating or worrying or drinking or whatever. But then we can also bring in curiosity as something, as an alternative that actually feels better itself.
There's a note here that I wrote after reading through parts of your book yesterday because your book is so interconnected and relatively complex for a simpleton like me, I don't know what the note means anymore. So I'm going to ask a question that doesn't make any sense to me, and you can explain it. Perhaps it will make sense to you. And the note is, when we're curious and we start asking ourselves what you're just talking about here, about why we do the things and how it impacts us when we think about it, that's knowledge. But we also know that we're overeating or that we are smoking too much or whatever it may be. Those are two pieces of information. One is not as powerful as the other. Why? Does it have to do with something you wrote about where the frontal cortex has an intellectual understanding that goes offline when we're stressed, essentially?
Yes. And so you can think of our thinking brains, they are not nearly as strong as our feeling bodies. I think of it as the thinking brain doesn't hold a candle to our feeling bodies. What I mean by that is we can know something is bad for us. For example, I don't have no single patient has ever come to me, thinking that smoking was good for them. For example, they can know that smoking is bad for them intellectually, but yet they can't break the bad habit. And that's because the cravings come from their bodies. It's their body saying, do this, do this. And it outcompetes the thinking brain. So intellectual understanding is helpful. I think of this as concepts in the service of wisdom, but really it's our direct experience that's going to either perpetuate a habit or help us break it.
Most of the bad habits that we develop, you say, are really addictions. And most of us think of people who have addictions as being drug addicts or people who overconsume alcohol, maybe overeat, etc. But you say that everyone is addicted. How so?
I know, that's a bold claim. Well, I learned this very simple definition of addiction in residency training, which is continued use despite adverse consequences. And so I'm guessing that all of us, if not almost all of us, can relate to something that we keep doing despite adverse consequences, whether it's texting while we're driving. There are certainly adverse consequences there. It's more dangerous than drunk driving. Whether it's, spending extra time scrolling on social media where we're not getting anything from it and it's actually preventing us from getting our work done or from, from connecting with our families. I think we all have something where we're doing it despite adverse consequences. We're continuing to use it despite adverse consequences.
Is addiction always the underlying cause of our addictions?
What a great koan. Is addiction the underlying cause? So I would say this learning process, if you think of addiction, because addiction is formed through this learning process, and this learning process is something that we all have.
I think I misasked the question. Is anxiety always the underlying cause of these addictions? I'm sorry. Two A words. I got them confused.
Yeah. It's not always, although okay. I see a huge amount of it being, a huge number of, or amount of addiction being driven by anxiety. So a large number of my patients have anxiety that then drives them to an addiction.
So when we come back, we'll talk about mindfulness as a way to break these addictions and these bad habits with Dr. Judd Brewer in Charlotte Talks. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking to Dr. Judson Brewer, medical doctor, PhD, with a psychiatrist and a neuroscientist and the executive medical director of behavioral health at ShareCare. That's a digital health company, among other things, including being an associate professor of psychiatry in the School of Public Health at Brown University and the author of Unwinding Anxiety, which is what we're talking about today, the new science that shows how to break the cycles of worry and fear to heal your mind. A lot of the bad habits that we have been talking about that are the underlying cause of which is anxiety are things that have come about because we in America, at least, and probably in the 21st century around the world, have this need for and expectation of instant gratification, which seems to me to also be a habit fed by anxiety. We want it, and we want it now because it will help us now, whatever it may be. You say the 21st century world is increasingly designed to create experiences that are addictive. So how do we know when those addictions are coming from that, from these companies that are forcing us to do these things because it makes them money versus we're doing these things because we think it's going to cure our anxiety or make us feel better?
Well, this is it's a great question. And we can look at this in terms of what our consumatory behaviors are around anxiety. So again, our brain's tendency is to say, anxiety feels bad, make it go away. And if somebody can say, I'll make it go away in 5 minutes, and somebody else says, I'll make it go away in 2 minutes, and somebody else says, I'll make it go away instantaneously, whose product are we going to buy? And so we can look at what we do to make our anxiety go away. It could be simply the attention economy, where we're not buying a good per se, but we're spending time on social media, for example. So we go and scroll on social media and we distract ourselves almost immediately. Or if you look at consumatory behavior, you know, I write a little bit in the book about, you know, buying shoes. You know, back in the 1800s, if somebody needed a new pair of shoes, they couldn't just, you know, open up the Amazon app and, you know, click the, you know, the 2-day delivery or the 2-hour delivery or whatever there is now and just get the shoes. Where they had to say, well, why, you know, why am I uncomfortable? Is it because there's a hole in my shoe? Or is it because I just had a fight with my spouse, you know? And so we might buy shoes today because we had a fight with our spouse. But back then, you know, it was like, oh, I actually need shoes.
And you'd have to get in your horse and buggy, go to town, maybe an hour and a half to go to town, get measured for the shoes, talk about what kind of shoe you wanted, go back home, and in a couple of weeks when the shoes were ready, drive back into town and get the shoes. And it gave you time to think about it. Do I really need these shoes? That's mindfulness. That's mindfulness.
It is. So I think of mindfulness as basically awareness, like being aware of something that's happening, but also bringing an attitude of, this goes back to what you said earlier, this attitude of curiosity. So not prejudging a situation, saying, oh, that's good or that's bad, but simply saying, oh, well, what is actually happening right now? So we're seeing things very clearly.
And rather being, because a lot of people are they poo-poo or they don't like the idea of meditation or really whatever other ingredients go into being mindful. But you also say, since we're always looking for things to make us feel better, curiosity, being mindful, you say, makes us feel better, right?
Absolutely. Yes, I would say, you know, my lab actually did a study about this, which might sound like a no-brainer when you hear it, but we had to do this research to prove it. We gave people a list of a bunch of different psychological states, and we had them rank them in order of preference, basically which one they preferred and which one they didn't. And we found that anxiety, not surprisingly, is ranked pretty low. You know, anxiety, frustration, anger, things like that. And things like curiosity are ranked very highly, where they are much preferred to anxiety. So our brains seem to have a natural reward hierarchy where they preference things like curiosity, things like kindness, over anxiety and, you know, divisiveness, for example.
You talk about how breaking the smoking habit. One of your patients, you asked them to think about it, why they do it, and what it feels like when they do it. And they realized suddenly that it tastes awful. It doesn't make me feel good. Why am I doing this? And that helped them to break the habit. And that's also being mindful. So if we think about, why am I drawn to my phone every 5 minutes to check my emails? What is driving me to that habit? Will that, because these are habit loops. You refer to them as habit loops. So we go back to them and keep doing them, hoping for a result that never comes. Will the realization of that help us break those habits?
That realization is actually the first step. And so I've actually set up the book as a 3-step process. Mm-hmm. The first step is being able to identify and map out these habit loops. In fact, anybody can do this. I do this with my patients in my office where, you know, if they come to me the first, you know, their first visit, I map out. So what's the behavior that you're struggling with? Let's say worrying. Okay, what triggers it? You know, it's that I have a thought about getting in a car accident or something like that. Okay, what's the result of that? Well, I avoid driving on the highway. I actually wrote about a patient who had full-blown panic disorder around driving, where we map this out. And then just in a couple of minutes, anybody can start to see what these habit loops are and how they're showing up every day. Mm-hmm. But the second step is really the most critical piece and gets back to this reward value, which is if something is rewarding, we're going to keep doing it. If something's habitual, we're not going to actually pay attention to the reward, so we're going to keep doing it. So with smoking, for example, Most of my patients start smoking in their early teens. And so they're not even paying attention to the reward value. They're just relieving that nicotine deficit that says, ooh, this feels uncomfortable, make that go away. So they get nicotine in their system through smoking. But if they really pay attention as they smoke, they realize that cigarettes taste like crap. And that helps them start to become disenchanted with the process of smoking without forcing themselves or telling themselves that smoking is bad for them. It really is that visceral feeling of, oh, this isn't very rewarding. And their brain reward value updates. And in fact, it doesn't even take that long to do that. We did a study with our Eat Right Now app where we found that 10 to 15 times of people paying attention as they overate helped them totally drop that reward value below zero.
You have animated, on your website, you have some animations that deal with this reward value quotient and how it's at the top. And even though there is a nicotine reward to smoking, when you first start, you don't have a nicotine addiction. And you talk about how teenagers sometimes start smoking because they just want to be cool. They want to be like the cool kids who are out on the back parking lot smoking cigarettes. It makes them feel good. Yeah. That's the key. It makes them feel good. And suddenly the nicotine makes them feel good. And you talk about ways and you display that that throws them up to the high on the reward scale. But as they get older and they realize that's not cool, doing this is not really cool and it's hurting my health and it doesn't taste good, that recognition helps them lower the reward scale. And that's what leads to breaking the addiction. Is that right?
Absolutely. So you both realizing that, hey, it's actually uncool to smoke, so that reward's not there. But also seeing, oh, you know, the taste of a cigarette's pretty crappy. My smoker cough in the morning is pretty crappy. When my partner doesn't want to kiss me because my breath, you know, is terrible. All of those negative rewards help drop that reward value even more.
And that can be applied to almost any habit that we pick up. Laura on Facebook brings up something I wanted to talk about too. She talks about your story with Anderson Cooper a couple of years ago on 60 Minutes, presented a compelling case for mindfulness meditation, particularly when Anderson returned to your lab to measure brain activity during stressful moments versus mindful moments. I watched this clip yesterday. You got Anderson Cooper in this hat attached to his perfect hair, filled with gel, and you are literally able, you tell him to think of, you hook him up to a computer, you tell him to think of a moment in his life or moments in his life that he found particularly stressful. Mm-hmm. And you can see the brain activity on a computer screen, and it's off the charts. And then you say, think about something that's pleasant, that you find pleasant. And almost instantly, it declines. You're showing beyond a shadow of a doubt, essentially, that mindfulness, thinking about things, can change how you feel and therefore your behaviors?
Well, it's specifically, we had him drop into meditation, I believe. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily thinking of a pleasant thought, because sometimes a pleasant thought can be pleasant. And sometimes we're like, oh, I need to think of something pleasant. And then we get caught up in trying to think of something pleasant and it backfires on us. So here, what doesn't backfire is present moment awareness, right? That's what mindfulness is about. And that attitude of curiosity. And so he was dropping into being curious about what the physical sensations of his breathing were like. And we found that this network of brain regions that my lab's been studying for over a decade now, which gets activated when we get caught up in worry, for example, and also gets activated when we get caught up in craving for cigarettes or alcohol or even chocolate, that gets really quiet when we're curious. And so here, not only does that brain region quiet down, but we can link this back into reward value. So anybody can compare for themselves what feels better, a craving or curiosity. And in our studies, you know, curiosity is much more rewarding than a craving, especially if we're a slave to our craving, where cravings are constantly driving our lives.
And a lot of people find this esoteric or, you know, sci-fi or, you know, gobbledygook. You say it's really not. I mean, we've come to understand the benefits of exercise, physical exercise, and that this is the next logical step.
Yes. I mean, we train our bodies to be physically fit. Why can't we train our minds to be physically fit? And, you know, to the gobbledygook point, it's interesting. You know, as a scientist, I don't believe something until I actually see it scientifically proven, when there's something that we can scientifically test. You know, this this isn't about faith or, you know, religion or things like that, which we, you know, we don't really, can't really test. But this is really about, you know, if you look at a behavior, you can test to see if something works. So for example, you know, we've studied these things, these app-based mindfulness training programs. We got 5 times the quit rates of gold standard treatment for smoking cessation. We got 40% reduction in craving-related eating with the Eat Right Now app. And with this unwinding anxiety app that my lab studied, we got a 67% reduction in clinically validated symptoms in people with generalized anxiety disorder. Now, just to bring this back to, I think, something we talked about earlier in the program, with medications, you know, that number needed to treat is 5.15. I have to treat 5 patients before one person benefits. In our study, that number needed to treat was 1.6. So many fewer people had to try the treatment before they saw very significant benefit. So to me, you know, science is helping us, you know, separate what is gobbledygook versus what might actually be real and reproducible.
Is this really a manifestation of mind over matter?
Depends on how you define mind. So I would say in short, yes. And a little bit longer explanation there is, if we understand how our minds work, we can work with our minds, and our minds are tremendously powerful.
So I know you have the book. We've talked about the book, Unwinding Anxiety, which talks about everything we've talked about here and more. You have your website, drjudd.com. You have an app that you just referred to that I know you have developed. But in the absence of all of those things, what can our listeners do if they recognize these habits, if they recognize feelings of anxiety, if just because of hearing this conversation, they've suddenly made the connection between, oh my gosh, I've been feeling anxious for a year now over this pandemic and politics and any other thing, and suddenly I realize, oh my gosh, I've gained 25 pounds, or I'm drinking all the time, or I'm smoking more, whatever it may be. How do they start down this road to fixing that?
Well, the nice thing is that it's a relatively simple process. It's not necessarily easy, but it is simple. And the first step is just mapping out these habit loops. So we actually have a habit mapper that's free that anybody can download. I think the website's mapmyhabit.com. So, you know, whether you download that or just write down trigger behavior result on a piece of paper and start mapping out your habit loops, anybody can do this, okay? Mm-hmm. Once we map out our habit loops, the second step is also pretty simple, which is to ask this question, what am I getting from this, right? Not intellectually, certainly the intellectual piece can help a little bit, but really viscerally, feeling this in our bodies. Like when I'm smoking a cigarette, what am I getting from this? Oh, crap. When I'm overeating, what does it feel like in my body? Oh, crap. When I'm worrying, what am I getting from this? Is it solving the problem? Is it helping me actually feel better, or is it making me more anxious? So that reduces the reward value. And then the third step is bringing in what I call the BBO, the bigger, better offer. And curiosity itself is one of those bigger, better offers. We've already talked about how curiosity feels compared to anxiety.
We've talked mostly about bad habits, but there are also good habits. And I guess one of the good habits would be learning how to meditate. How hard is it to create a good habit like that, to get into the habit of doing that, to learn how to do it and then do it on a regular basis?
Yeah. So I would say generally for creating any good habit, and I talk a little bit about this in the book, is that we really just have to see the rewards, how rewarding it is. So for example, my wife and I live in Massachusetts. It can get pretty cold here in the winter. And so she goes, you know, good habit that she has is exercising. So when she goes to go out for a run and she opens the door and it's icy cold, she might think, oh, do I really want to go for a run? But then she can remember, well, what was it like the last time I went for a run? And she can recall, oh, every time I run, it actually feels pretty good. So just that recollection of a good habit can help us perpetuate it. And that can go for everything from running to meditation.
Another example of mindfulness, just recognizing what you feel like in the moment and then trying to connect the dots to see why, what's causing that good feeling or that bad feeling. Dr. Judd Brewer, psychiatrist, neuroscientist, author of Unwinding Anxiety, New Science Shows How to Break the Cycles of Worry and Fear to Heal Your Mind. Thank you for the hour. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, pledging to help end child hunger in the Carolinas through ongoing support of Second Harvest Food Bank of Metrolina. Details about this initiative at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.